Indoor skydiving with VR, macOS Mojave, and Apple Watch 4 reviewed, and the best DIY home security systems. Live from the Twit Studio in Petaluma, California, it's the new Screensavers.
Who's that?
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
The new Screensavers is brought to you by CashFly. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network. For a complimentary, detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends, visit twit.cashfly.com. I know you think you're watching a rerun, but it's a brand new show, episode 176, Saturday. Let me just check to make sure. Yep, it's September 29th.
It is.
2018.
This is real life.
I'm back, Leo Laporte, and who else is back?
Father Robert Ballester.
Hey, Father Robert Ballester. What are you doing here?
You can't keep me away. You can't keep me away. Actually, it was Dreamforce and Oculus Connect 5 were
cool.
In town. So I remember I got the deal when I accepted this assignment. I said, can I come back 4 times a year for tech events?
Yeah.
And this was the first one.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we're going to really not
see me.
We're not going to
really. A couple of months.
So can I have the money back I gave you for the going away present?
That's spent. That was all spent.
No, it's great to have you.
Thank you.
So nice to see you. We've got an amazing show, which we planned just for Father Robert. We're going to talk about Mac OS Mojave, came out this week, the new dark mode and all that stuff. Andrew Cunningham of Ars Technica is following in a great tradition with his 20,000-word review of Mac OS Mojave. He'll join us to talk about why he says this is one of the best Mac updates in years.
That's right. And also, Jason Howell, as we all know, is always looking for new ways to use VR. He's done bumper cars. He's done roller coasters. He's even tried an omnidirectional treadmill with quadraphonic sound pressure thingy, whatever, from Ready Player One. But this time, he's going skydiving at iFly and their new VR experience.
That sounds nuts. We have the new Apple Watch in-house. I have the 44-millimeter Series 4. It's a big redesign. In fact, the first redesign since the Zero, Series Zero Apple Watch. And I'll save my review.
Yes,
a little later on.
Now, speaking of reviews, we get a review from our very own Florence Ion on a topic that's a little near and dear to my heart. That's IoT. Specifically, she's looking for the best home security system you can get out of IoT today.
Yes, as you know, Florence and Megan took over from you
for
know-how. They did 12 episodes of IoT. And the next one's going to be
Jason and Sam Moskovich.
Sam Moskovich, yeah. And they're doing gaming. So I think that's pretty cool.
I kind of like that because it breaks up know-how into different topics. We always try to throw a mix, but, you know, you kind of need a little steam. You got to gather some
legs. We realized we couldn't replace you, to be honest. And we were trying to think, well, what can we do with this show without Robert? And the idea of having seasons so that we could rotate hosts came to me, and I thought that would be great. Except now I'm regretting it because the next season is mine.
Wow, it's 6 years since you've been on Know How? It'll be amazing.
I don't even
It'll
know.
Be awesome.
Anyway, well, I'll have to think about what I'm going to do. Let's take a look at the news of the week. It's crazy time, I'll tell you. Facebook news, number one. I just want to say this to people so that they can do something about it. Facebook, there have been security issues with Facebook in the past, but this is easily the worst I've seen.
By far.
50 million Facebook accounts breached.
Oh, up to 90 by this morning.
Yeah, well, this is the funny thing is that, and as usual with Facebook, you know, they downplayed it at first. They said, well, nobody lost any data. And then at first they said 50 million. Now they're saying 90 million. So this is the issue. It was a hack. You've probably seen this feature in Facebook where you can see what your page looks like to other people, not to yourself logged in, but to what other people.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out there were 3 separate exploits on that code that allowed bad guys to get your super secret Facebook token. That's the cookie that gets saved on your hard drive when you first log into Facebook so you don't have to keep logging in. The problem with that token is if anybody else gets it, neither do they.
Yeah.
And so potentially this means many, many Facebook users could have their accounts, you know, somebody could post on your behalf.
Hijacked.
They could go through your account. It could be hijacked. It could be stolen. They changed the password, changed the email address. Now it's theirs. You know, Karsten had this happen to him. Somebody stole his account last year. And we never figured out why, and Facebook never knew why. Maybe this is it. This flaw has been around for a while.
It's been around for a while, and it's only getting attention now because they've started to realize, wow, this is now pervasive. Now, here's the thing. When they talked about a Facebook breach, it made me laugh at first because there is no information that Facebook has about you that they're not willing to sell. So when they say breach, what they really meant is someone stole some of our product and we didn't get paid for it.
Dang it.
However, and you picked up on this, that's a lot of us, I include myself in this, don't really use Facebook except for when it logs us into other sites. It makes it a very convenient one login platform.
Anthony Nielsen was saying that's why he can't get rid of his Facebook account.
Right.
Because he wouldn't be able to log in. And, you know, when I deactivated my Facebook account. I did have to figure out, well, how am I guess I have to re-log in. Waze was an example. I used Facebook to use the Waze navigation app. So I had to create a new account.
Yep.
That's all right. It wasn't the end of the world.
Now, they do have instructions. You're supposed to log out. So completely log out. Don't just close the browser.
So if you're using Facebook, anybody, because no one knows who's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So what should you do? You log out.
Log out, which will kill the cookie.
Delete your account. Oh, no. That's me talking. That's editorializing. Okay, log out.
And then just log back in. And they say they've already expired their certificates, expired those cookies that will allow it to log into third-party websites. But that's assuming that all of those third-party websites have properly implemented that authentication, which you can't really count on. This actually has me a little scared because there are a couple of sites that I use that I only have a Facebook login. I haven't enabled any other type of login.
It says, as a result, about 90 million people will have to re-log in to Facebook because that token has been expired.
Wow. But, you know, for me, Leo, this might be just the thing that pushes me and says, look, I haven't actually used Facebook as a social media service for years. Maybe it's time for me just to dump it.
It's a great feeling.
Go to a different authentication.
I'm just saying, it's a great feeling. Yeah. There was another issue with Facebook. It turns out, and Kashmir Hill wrote the article about this on Gizmodo a couple of days ago. Researchers at a number of universities found out that Facebook, if you give Facebook, for security reasons, a phone number for two-factor authentication, which you should probably do, they will turn around, add it to your profile, and sell ads against it.
But Leo, they are super, super secret about that, okay? That will never, ever leak. They would never, ever sell it. Okay, of course they're going to sell it. That's a horrible, horrible idea. Just assume any information that you give to Facebook, they're going to sell in some way, shape, or form. Just take that.
Yeah, and I've always said that even if you post privately on Facebook, you consider it that you're posting it publicly.
Well, I mean, Facebook really is only the place to find classmates that you've lost contact with or family that you really don't want to talk to. So.
Right. That's perfect for that.
All right.
Uh-huh. What else happened? Oh, Elon Musk. What's the latest? Oh, he's agreed. Okay. So... Elon, I don't know where to begin. First of all, Elon, get off Twitter. Another thing everybody should get off. He tweeted, a couple of months ago, that he was ready to take Tesla private.
And funding had been secured.
Funding
That's
secured.
The, key.
The most expensive two-word tweet in the history of mankind because, A, funding wasn't secured, and B, the price of Facebook soared as a result, the stock price.
Because $420 was way above what it had been trading at. So essentially, he gave insider information to everyone on Twitter, and they acted on it. That's a big no-no.
It's kind of a big deal because you could use that to pump the stock up and then sell your shares.
Pump and dump.
Pump and dump, it's called. It happens all the time. And that's when the Securities and Exchange Commission gets involved. They did an investigation, and they went after Elon. They said, look, you have a couple of choices. We could go to court. You could be tried for this. You could even face jail time.
Yep.
Or we'll settle with you. You got to get off the board. We want two seats on the board. A bunch of stuff. Elon said, no way I'd do that. Well, apparently that was a negotiation ploy because just shortly before we began the show, it was announced that the SEC has settled with Elon Musk. He will remain as CEO.
But he loses the chairman.
He will no longer be chairman. And this is why it's the most expensive tweet in history. He will pay a $20 million fine, and his company will pay a $20 million fine. That means $20 million a word for funding secured. That was a very expensive mistake.
And look, I understand why they do this, because, yes, you can't have CEOs, Tesla or any other company, doing something that radically affects the stock price, even if they're not personally benefiting from it, they could have acquaintances who are, and that's clearly illegal. However, we were talking about this before the show. It's kind of funny that the same federal agency was okay with Elizabeth Holmes continuing her role as CEO of Theranos. It's like, wait a minute, that was clearly fraud. Right. This was some guy who was stressed out and did something stupid, and you're stripping all this power away from him. Elizabeth Holmes, you basically said, well, it's bad enough that you lost your company. Go on, continue.
Who was it? It was 50 Cent. Or is it, as I say, as our people say, 50 cents.
50. It's 50 Cent.
50 Cent.
Thank you.
Tweeted that he liked an investment. And he made $10 million after tweeting, plugging that stock on Twitter. This was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
No fine, no penalty, nothing. The reason Elon is getting in trouble is because the words funding secured weren't true.
Right. Right.
That, in fact, the deal wasn't done. He had in his mind that the Saudi royal family was going to buy it because he'd had some conversations with
them. I'm sure in his mind it made sense. Right. It just doesn't meet what we would actually consider funding secured, which is there's a document signed saying we will turn over this money to you as soon as you want to go forward with the deal. In his mind, he's like, oh, yeah, I talked to these people, and they said they were totally interested. So, okay.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I tweet that?
Well, there you go.
Sorry, Elon.
But now, you got to know what's illegal in this country. And apparently, funding secured is one of them.
Yeah.
Finally, let's talk about the Oculus Vision.
Oh,
you were there.
Yes, I was. Oculus Connect 5.
Speaking of Facebook.
I know.
Zuckerberg's speaking at these, right?
He always starts. You'll see he's like the first 15 minutes of the keynote on the first day. And so he came in and he did his Zuckerberg thing. He had a little bit of technical difficulties at the start. The microphone wasn't working, but they got that sorted out. And you could quickly tell that the whole show, the whole conference was really about the end, what he calls the end of first-generation VR. So they've now got the Rift, they've got the Go, and now they've got the Quest. That's the one that was newly released. Now, the Quest is fascinating. I got a look at this last year when it was still called Project Santa Cruz. This actually started developing before the Go. It's a higher resolution. It's 1600 by 1440. It uses a Qualcomm Snapdragon 835, so it's decently powered. But that picture there, that's actually how it looks because there's no wires. It's not like other
headsets.
There's
no wires.
Everything is wireless from the two controllers, which are kind of like the controllers that you've seen before, slightly different, and to the headset. So that is the entire setup. No extra computer required. Now, there's an interesting thing that he talked about, which is the Rift was really 100% for gaming, and they figured out some other things they could do.
Right.
The Go was really an afterthought. It came out of the development of Project Santa Cruz, and they said, well, let's see if a headset would succeed if it was 80% other and only 20% gaming. And they said they were surprised.
Other being things like watching movies in a movie theater.
Precisely, because they didn't actually know if people would want to do that.
Right.
And they thought, okay, people are going to buy this, and then it will sit dormant. They said their retention rate, so the number of people who continue to use it after they've purchased it, is actually on par with the Rift. So there's definitely a market. This Project Santa Cruz is wonderful because it is one of these pick-up-and-go technologies.
It's also less expensive. It's $400.
$400.
You don't need a computer or a smartphone.
Right, and it's completely inside out, so no external sensors. And it will.
Is it six-axis?
Six DOF.
Six
degrees of freedom. Degrees of freedom.
So that's important, too. What is it? So there's forward, there's backward, there's up, down, left, right. Is that six?
Right, right. And because the Go was only three.
Right.
And what happened with a lot of people is it was fine as long as you were sitting. But the second
you
get
forward,
up, it could disorient you. This will do the same as the Rift. And the tracking is spot on because what it will do, anytime you walk into a room, and you can calibrate for multiple rooms, it will look for the edges and the corners. That becomes its reference point, and then it will scan the rest of the room. It makes a wireframe of the rest of the room. So you just spin around a couple of times, and it does all of this.
That's wild.
And it glues you. I mean, the positioning is really, really tight.
So you played with it.
I played with it. I did Super Hot.
And what's Super Hot?
Super Hot is that game where time doesn't move unless you move.
And that sounds kind of fun.
It completely changes the game because I've always played tethered. So you could move like 3 feet. This was an entire room. You could move around the entire room to get the right angles. It's not just better. It is a completely different VR experience.
Now I feel bad because I have a wired Oculus Rift.
It's not
this
the same.
Sounds like it's better.
It's so much better. Just the lack of the cable makes it so much better.
But you said something intriguing. All of the above are first-generation VR experiences. What does Zuckerberg think the next generation is going to be like?
So that was Carmack the next day. Okay. And when he started talking about...
John Carmack, who was formerly of id, creator of Doom, he now is a high-level employee at Oculus.
Oh, and by the way, he is incredible because after his keynote, he ran out of time. He just stood outside.
Yeah.
And people just came around
people
and asked him
questions. People
love Carmack. That's incredible.
He's an amazing guy.
But he was talking about how the screens in the Quest could technically go 1600 by 1440, but with only a Snapdragon 835, you can't really push that with a frame rate that's decent.
Okay.
So, you know, he's also was saying they want a better way to bring other people into your VR experience. It's one thing to have this thing on your face.
But it's when you say second generation, it sounds like a new hardware design. It's not really. It's just different features.
I'm betting it's going to be the first thing that you're going to see from second generation is just specs ramped up.
Okay.
Better processors, better screens.
I'd like to see that. Higher frame rate, higher resolution.
Right.
I'd like to see that.
But
4K.
What they're really going for is, and they got, it's decent. I mean, I saw the hub, the Oculus hub, and it actually worked pretty well, where you would put on your goggles, and you would have a wireframe of the real world, but then you had a really easy way to put screens so you could actually type and work inside of this environment.
Yeah. So more like an augmented reality experience.
Far, far closer. Yeah. And one of the things
we call it mixed reality.
Mixed reality.
It's mixed reality.
He, and I'm hoping he can go through on this, he's saying within the next couple of years, controllerless hand tracking. So once you can ditch the controllers,
right.
I mean, that's the kind of AR/VR that we
want. Magic Leap does that, by the way.
Magic Leap does do that. But I mean, he was saying that it's so processor intensive that you can't do it without either taking a huge hit in performance or having a separate processor that sucks battery.
Right.
But I mean,
that's going to be the big challenge is to get these in small devices you can wear and you can wear all day and that will work untethered. That's a hard thing to do.
It's a very hard thing to
do. Maybe that's the third generation.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, cool. Sounds like $399 spring 2019. Sounds like a lot of people who use Oculus. They said, 50 games on ship.
Yeah.
So that's good.
And now, I will say, if you're thinking about getting a Go, don't.
Wait at this point,
wait,
right?
Seriously, get wait this. For this.
Okay.
It's
$100 more.
It's it's more, but for that, you get a better experience.
Yeah.
And you will end up using it for things other than games.
Right.
Which I kind of like.
Andrew Cunningham is on the line from Ars Technica. We're going to talk about the new Mac OS Mojave in just a second. But first, a word from our sponsor. The people who bring you the new screensavers and all the Twitch shows. And when I say bring you, literally bring you these shows. When you download any of our shows, you're not downloading it from us or our servers. You're downloading it from our content distribution network, Cashfly. You've heard me thank Cashfly on every one of our shows for a decade now. And I mean it. I really thank them. Twit wouldn't exist without this incredible high-powered backbone. Cashfly is affordable for us. If you deliver content, whether you're a game company or a podcast company or video company, if you deliver content to end users, you love having a CDN because multiple servers mean your endpoint is always close to your users, faster downloads. But there's nothing like the CDN service you get from Cashfly. First of all, 100% availability, a bulletproof 100% SLA. That's important for us. Because that means if you can't download the new screensavers, I'm going to get a call in the middle of the night. We've been using Cashfly 10 years. I have never, ever been getting a call in the middle of the night. They also help me a lot with planning for bills. Bandwidth usage is spiky, as you know. Maybe we have a show that everybody downloads one day, and suddenly my bill goes up, not with Cashfly. With Cashfly, you know exactly what you're going to pay. And it is less, about on average, 20% less than those other guys. It is fantastic. You're not locked into a contract that's inflexible. It's built around your unique demand, your unique traffic patterns. We literally push petabytes a month from Cashfly at an affordable price. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week or even daily trying to track your CDN usage. You will save on average more than 20%. And you'll never have a call in the middle of the night saying, the CDN's down. What do we do now, Leo? Twit.cashfly.com. Go there right now and find out what Cashfly can do for you right now. They're giving you a free detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends so you can see, am I leaving money on the table? Can I save money with Cashfly? I almost guarantee you can. See there, that button, analyze my CDN bill. Just go there right now. Twit.cashfly.com. And we thank Cashfly so much. Without Cashfly, there is no Twit.
You know, Leo, I have to say that your Cashfly ads have kind of saved my sanity the last couple of weeks.
What's that?
I've been doing the immersion Italian.
Yeah?
And you get to that point where your brain is just, it doesn't want to process anything anymore. And so I'll turn on a podcast, and it's that cachefly.com. And then just, I hear that, I'm like, okay.
English.
I'm all right.
Something like it, anyway. You said, I don't think I'm giving anyone any confidence, but you had to go to a big meeting, a Curia meeting.
I did.
In Italian. They speak Italian at these. Not Latin. Italian, right?
Italian.
And you said, I thought this was interesting, you used your phone to translate. Did you do that?
I did.
What program do you use?
Microsoft Translate. Because it does it in real time.
It's really good, isn't
it? It's fantastic.
So you put it there. They're speaking Italian. And then what, you have a headphone?
I have a Bluetooth headphone. And so I just put it near them. And as they speak, it just continuously translates into
English.
And
it did it accurately?
Oh, yeah. Accurately enough, where between what I knew of Italian,
you knew some Italian,
and what I could see in English, that
wow. So your Italian's gonna be good though soon, right?
The problem
Italian's
is
easy.
The campus on which I live, the primary language is English. The secondary language is Spanish, and the tertiary language is Italian. You step outside our walls,
that's extremely
the
confusing.
The primary is Italian,
right?
English is like fourth or fifth.
Yeah, so that's very confusing.
Yeah. We'll see. I know a couple of phrases, like, per scusi, dove è biblioteca, which is...
Where's the library?
Excuse me, where's the library?
Yeah, that's good. You need to know that. do you have those great, the Swiss guards? Do you have them outside your house?
I have a good Swiss guard story. So
these are the official papal
guards,
and they wear beautiful uniforms.
The uniforms look, you know, you go, oh, it's so colorful, but then you see the automatic rifles.
They
on
also
the
carry
AR-15s. They don't carry the halberds anymore.
No,
but so I was on our roof, which is it's in the Vatican, and I wanted to get some aerial video of our campus. So
you didn't bring out the drone.
I did. I put the drone down, and
Robert,
I look over, and there's a Swiss guard looking at me. I'm like, okay. So I start throwing it up, and I have it like this much. And now he's staring at me. I'm like, no. Okay. Coming back down. Sorry about that. I'm out.
You don't want to know the Italian for that.
He didn't even have to say a word. It was just that look of like, oh, yeah, staring intensifies. I'm out.
Are they actually Swiss?
Originally, yes. So the story behind the Swiss Guard is, and the reason why they've become the Pope's personal guard is the mercenary company, the Swiss Guard, the original one, was wiped out because they bought enough time for the Pope to escape to Avignon.
Oh, my.
So that, they became the guys. They have always been the Pope's guard.
Wow. And by the way, they have halberds in the pictures on the website.
Those are just ceremonial.
That's not...
They have modern automatic machine guns.
Don't mess with the... Okay.
And actually, they're incredibly well-trained. They're very, very well-trained.
Even though they're wearing blue and gold striped socks.
Don't let that sucker you.
Okay. These are why the gloves, they hide a fist of iron. All right. Last week, actually, I guess it was Monday. It was this week. Apple released OS 10, or I'm sorry, I'm in the old school, Mac OS Mojave.
There we
10.14. It is a grand tradition at Ars Technica. It was started by John Siracusa. Andrew Cunningham has taken it over since El Capitan to write the definitive, long-form, novel-length review of the new Mac OS. Andrew Cunningham has finally got some sleep. And he's joining us right now from Ars Technica. It's great. How long was your review?
The review is around 17,000 words total, plus screenshots and captions and stuff that got, you know, left on the cutting room floor. So, yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
And John used to say at the end of that, he was just like drained. There was nothing left for a week. Like, he just had to go home.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Like, the first thing I do is get 8 hours of sleep for the first night in like 2 weeks. And then the night after that, I will go out and have a nice beer somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah, but I mean, your work is so unlike what we see on most of the YouTube culture.
Exactly right.
It's not an unboxing.
Shallow. It's in depth. And I mean, I know you start the minute they ship out the first beta. That's, you know, so you've been working on this for maybe 8 or 9 months. And then it comes out. But I have to tell you, I think everybody who really is interested in Macintosh, this is the must-read article. You you care most about what's Andrew going to say. Tell us about it. And I go through, look at this table of contents. I will go through the table of contents looking for details.
Wow.
And then I will download, I'm a subscriber to Ars Technica, so I'll download the PDF, keep it on my iPad so that I can refer to it. I mean, it is the manual that Apple doesn't write, basically. So thank you for doing it. I'm really grateful.
Well, you are so welcome.
Yeah. Well, I know you hear this a lot because it's true. So
that's the intent, though, is to try and be kind of a reference guide.
Yes.
I will go back to my old reviews because, you know, the day after it's published, I just have to push all of it out of my brain or I can't, you know, survive.
I was just going to say that. So much of this is this is not a first type piece of content. This is something that people will be going back to over the next couple of years.
This is last. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I, of course, immediately installed it like every good Mac user. The first thing you note is they give you a choice of light mode or dark mode. Let me open the system because I chose. Who isn't? I chose dark mode.
I think everyone's right.
Who's not going to choose dark mode? But you can. Light mode is the mode you're used to. Dark mode you choose. But the other thing I noticed immediately is they don't give you these great wallpapers right out of the box. I mean, they do, but they don't give you the best part of the wallpapers, which is that they change over time. So the next thing I tell people to do is go to that next system preference pane and choose dynamic so you can see the desert change. And as the sun goes down, the dunes get dark. It's kind of cool. It's a beautiful wallpaper.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. I think there's no official way that Apple makes for third parties to make their own like custom wallpapers to do that.
Bad.
But I think people have already figured it
have
out.
They hacked? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Anyway, dark mode gets a lot of attention. I guess we should say, do you like it?
I do like it.
Is it good?
I do like it. Yeah, I mean, I default to dark mode mostly these days. The other thing that's in there that you might have noticed that I think is kind of neat visually is they have this accent color now. So since macOS 10 has like been a thing, the two color options have been, you know, you can have blue like scroll bars and check boxes, or you can have black and white like graphite.
So there's highlight color, which we've had forever. What is accent color?
Accent colors, so
it's changing the control colors.
Right. Yeah. So and you can, you know, pick different combinations in light and dark mode, and they all look pretty cool. I usually default to red or purple. I think those are the most, you know, you just have
That's
to show
you have
off
no
that you're
taste.
Using new thing.
It's clear that gray is the only choice.
You like gray? You know, that's fine. You pick what you want.
But it matches my hair.
I'd like to send out a message to all the press who goes to tech events. If you're in a dark auditorium and you're using a Windows or a Mac notebook,
turn on
dark mode or turn on high contrast mode because I hate watching those bright screens. Dark mode actually does help quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed, and I know we were talking about this on MacBreak Weekly, is that they don't offer you a different color for the text. And so when I look at San Francisco in the new dark mode menu bar, the text doesn't look quite right. It looks like it's like the thickness of the strokes are a little bit off or something. It doesn't look as good as the white. So somebody suggested maybe offering a lower contrast color for the text as well would be just for the next edition, Apple, just something.
Yeah, so, I'm sure like they'd tweak that stuff over the course of the betas, and I'm sure we'll see them keep tweaking it as they go. Like I think even the light mode has some tweaks to the way that like translucency and things look. So
okay, good.
Yeah, they're always fiddling. So.
I didn't know about the accent, so thank you. That was a great tip. The other thing that's I got very excited about when they showed it at WWDC is the new Quick Look. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when you like, it's especially noticeable, I think, on images and maybe PDFs as well. But Quick Look is that thing where if you hit the space bar when you're highlighting any file, like on your desktop or in the Finder anywhere, it gives you those little. It just gives you a quick look at the thing without opening up whatever app would normally open it up.
And
so
I can do some editing now. I can do some stuff to this, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, so they. Right at that top level, they let you rotate stuff. And that is actually, like, it's not rotating the preview. It's actually changing the file, like the way it would if you were rotating in Lightroom or in preview.
Right.
And then same with these, you know, the crops and the markup changes and stuff. Like, that's all happening to the file. You don't have to open preview. You're clicking right there. The signature thing's kind of neat.
Like that's cool. I could sign a document here, right?
Yeah, if you put in a signature, you can, like, you've been able to do it in preview for years, but now you can do it without needing needing to hop into another app.
That's
so,
really nice.
As I've freelance has been super helpful for signing contracts.
Yeah. Yeah. There was another feature I really like, which is the ability to scan into documents from your phone or your tablet. Tell us a little bit about that. It seems like that's a part of continuity.
Yeah. So they call that continuity camera. Yeah. And basically any iPhone or iPad that's within Bluetooth range of your Mac. So it's using the same kind of technology that they use to power like Handoff and the continuity copy paste thing that'll copy and paste text between two different devices. You can right click or go into the import menu. It depends on where.
Here I am in I'm in Pages right now, and there's a medium icon on there. And down here it says Leo's iPhone XS, and I can it says take photo. So now I'm opening my iPhone, and immediately it goes into the camera mode. I'm going to take a picture of you, Robert, because I think this document requires. And then it says use photo, and now watch. Go back to my screen because watch.
Oh,
it's in there already.
Is that not sweet? That's actually pretty quick.
That's not the best picture.
That's pretty neat. And you can scan documents like right to your desktop or, you know, right to emails. It's pretty cool.
I really think that's an interesting feature.
I've been using the Google Photos, but even that takes a couple of seconds.
Look how, did you see? It's instantaneous.
That was fast. That was really fast.
So preview, this new scan action, which I really like. Tell me about Stacks, because they made a big deal about this. I know a lot of people, no names, but whose entire desktop is loaded with icons, right? This is for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a feature. It's off by default, I think. But if you right-click your desktop or control-click your desktop and hit Use Stacks, it will look at all the different files you've got. So images, PDFs, like if you use, like I use Audacity to record audio a lot. So it sees those files and it groups them together into like these little smart folders that you can then, you know, collapse or uncollapse.
That is
to,
really
to clean your desktop up. And you can sort them a few different ways. I think by date is by one.
Kind, date, last open, date added. Date modified, tags.
And if you're a big user of tags in the Finder, it'll sort by that too. So it kind of piggybacking off of stuff that people are already using.
I find the one thing
that it won't group together is folders. So if you got a lot of those on your desktop, like they're going to stay on your desktop. But for images and PDFs and screenshots and all that stuff that tends to accumulate over the weeks and months. Yeah, it's a pretty handy way to just visually clean things up and make things look better without making you do any actual work to clean it up yourself.
I like it because it's Apple saying, all right, we know you're going to do this. In the past, engineers would say, well, just don't do that. But Apple's saying, no, people are going to save to the desktop. Let's give them a facility that makes it a little easier for them to find.
They need to add a function to Stacks that will automatically stack things. Because I know people who have multiple desktops just filled with icons.
They will. This does that. It goes...
And I know it's a personal preference, but that drives me crazy. It's like
I know
people who have a browser that has 400 tabs open. That's the same thing. It triggers my OCD.
They've always had password capabilities. Oh, here's a demo of the... So this is your OCD friend.
Yeah, see, that I would kill.
Turn on Stacks.
There, feel better.
Is that not awesome?
Thank you.
Although it would probably drive somebody who's used to those things crazy. What happened? I knew where everything was. Mom cleaned my bedroom.
On the next know-how, learn how to drive your Mac using friends crazy.
Security is always a concern. Apple Keychain's been pretty good for generating passwords and storing them, but they've actually amped that up a little bit too. Right, Andrew?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So there's a new feature that will offer some automatic strong passwords. So I think by default, like developers can put their own password rules in, so it'll always generate compliant passwords. But I think by default, it's like 20 characters and has a mix of numbers and letters and dashes. It can when you're creating an account on a site, it can offer a password for you to use automatically. And then if you've got the iCloud Keychain stuff on, it will then sync those across all the different Macs you're using. So for anybody, like it's not going to replace a password manager for anybody who's using one already, I don't think. But for people who aren't using one, I think this could be a replacement for that or an introduction to password managers. And then the other feature that's kind of related is in Safari, they've got this new thing called a password reuse tracking, where if you go into the Safari preferences and then to the passwords tab, it will, yeah, there you go. It'll flag every single time you have used a password on two or more sites.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
One of those classic things where you always tell everybody, don't use passwords, don't reuse passwords. But of course, everybody does it sometimes.
Yeah. On sites where I don't really care how secure they are. Except that maybe it should be a little more, because look at all of these. Holy cow.
Yeah, it'll direct you to go to the sites and then change them, and then you can use the strong password feature to switch them
Very
up and
nice.
Fix it.
Very nice. Safari's been updated. This is Safari 12. By the way, we should mention that because they're now being a little stricter on extensions, people are starting to see some compatibility issues, extensions thrown out.
Yep.
We have a check scanner from the bank, and the bank sent us a note saying, don't upgrade. we haven't been able to figure out how to make it work with Safari 12. So be aware of that. There are a lot of reasons not to upgrade, though, right? Most stuff still works.
Yeah, most stuff still works. And if you're not an extensions user, or if your extensions come from the officially sanctioned sources, so anything in the Mac App Store and anything from the Safari extensions gallery, the stuff that's hosted on Apple's website, that'll all still work. It'll be fine. But anything from outside either of those sources is just totally gone off by default. Can't turn it back on.
Wow.
No recourse. Like, good luck, everybody.
And I mean, that's the way it should be, right?
I guess. I'm torn. I mean, that's the way it should be maybe on mobile. But this is a computer, and I'm a computer user, and there's things I want to do. Gatekeeper's good, because Gatekeeper you could turn off. You could say, yeah, all right, I only want my mom to download from the Mac's App Store, but I want to be able to download from third-party sites. This isn't a case where you don't have – there's no way out. You can't say, well, I want to turn off that feature because I have an extension I want to use from a website. I know what I'm doing. You can't turn that off. Now, of course, you can always use Chrome. So
right.
I guess you can in a way, but I don't know. I'm a little torn.
I mean, if you're going to be allowing these extensions to have extended access,
which they do, yeah,
you kind of have to make sure that the vendor is willing to put in the time to keep them updated.
Right.
So I mean, I get it, and it's a huge harassment. Kerfuffle. I'm going to call it kerfuffle. It's a huge kerfuffle when it doesn't work because we expect things just to work.
Well, that's why I'm warning people, because what happened immediately for me, for instance, I use uBlock Origin. Immediately it was turned off.
Yeah.
I was able to go back out and find Gore Hill's extension. But at first I thought, wow, I have to use something else. I'm not happy about that. So that's something to be aware of. And our check scanner won't work. So I can't upgrade to Mojave on some of our office computers.
And it's going to get more restrictive. Like, I think for the next version of Safari, so whatever comes out next year, the plan is to disable the extensions gallery stuff too. So the Mac App Store will be the only place.
I got that feeling because it threw me to the App Store when I wanted to find it. It didn't mention that the extension gallery even exists.
You'll have to actually Google that. You have to keep one of your older MacBooks just to keep all of that.
Maybe.
And then this will be updated.
But, as you point out, Robert, the browser is basically the vector for most bad malware to get into a system. So that's the place
that's
where
the
you
cost
want the strongest
of having a secure system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about 32-bit apps? Can we still use these?
You can still use them. You will occasionally, I think, see a nag message that says, your app is out of date. Please contact the developer. But yeah, this will be the last version of macOS that can run old 32-bit apps.
OpenGL and OpenCL also, which is a big deal.
Yeah, so they've been less clear about their timeline for that. Yeah. And functionally, those APIs have not been updated in macOS for years and years. They are pushing people pretty aggressively to use Metal instead.
This requires Metal. If you don't have Metal capability, and many older Macs that would be perfectly capable of running Mojave can't run Metal, you can't run Mojave.
Right. Yeah, so anything made before 2012 except for a couple of old Mac Pros that you can put a new GPU in. So but you do need to do that before you can run Mojave. So
APFS now on Fusion drives, that's a big deal. Can we use it on external drives, or is it still just the internal drives?
Yeah, you can use it on anything. I had it running on an external hard drive, just like a spinning hard drive that I've got. So
I know the Synology products support them.
So do we like APFS? I think it's great, but is the consensus it's reliable, it's solid, and it's feature rich?
People have really had no problems with the transition. I have not seen any widespread complaints about it. You know, I've not been all over the Apple support forum, so maybe there's some edge cases that I'm not aware of. But I think for the vast majority of people, you know, the transition's happened and they've not noticed, which is as designed, I think.
And as good as you can get, because as anybody knows who's been playing with file systems, there are plenty of, for instance, on Linux file systems that are devastating. You can lose data and it's terrible. So to have this kind of transition to a good cache on write, you know, modern file system be so seamless, so transparent, and apparently so trouble free is really remarkable. Thank you, Apple, for doing a good job on APFS. And if you upgrade to Mojave and you haven't upgraded your internal drive, it'll probably do that for you automatically in most cases, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Including for Macs with spinning hard drives and fusion drives now. So those didn't get upgraded last year, but they will now.
Nice.
Andrew, I got to cheat here and ask, is there something that maybe not a deal killer really irked you about the upgrade?
Boy, about the upgrade. The compatibility stuff does kind of bother me a little bit. I'm mostly using newer Macs, but I know a lot of people who aren't. And High Sierra is still going to keep getting security updates and Safari updates and things for probably two more years. They tend to support the most recent release and then the two releases previous. So High Sierra and Sierra now should still be getting patches. But when you look at Microsoft's approach to Windows, which is, I don't think their system requirements have changed all that much since Windows 7 or Vista
They tried doing it. They tried really closely integrating with the hardware, and there was a revolt.
They're the kings of legacy, and Apple traditionally is not. Yep. Apple's traditionally cutting people off so that they can move forward. I think one thing everybody's going to be so excited about is the new Stocks app.
Of course, we save the best for last. This is the real killer feature of the operating system.
They install two or three iOS apps. I guess more to show that you can do it than anything else. Nobody wanted Stocks on their iPhone. Now you got it on your Mac too.
They've referred to it as a preview of what is coming next year. So next year they're going to extend this.
That sounds more technology like a threat than a promise.
They're gonna let iOS developers take their apps and port them relatively easily to the Mac. So you've got. What is it? News, Stocks, Home, and Voice Memos, I think, are the four in Mojave.
Okay. Apple can do this, though. This isn't something any iOS developer can do.
Yeah, and it's still pretty rough around the edges. Like, there are definitely places where you can tell that there are kind of iOS apps with a macOS wrapper around them.
Right.
And there are some questions, and I go into this in a little more detail in the review, but there are some questions about, you know, can iOS apps access all of the underlying hardware? Can they access the file system in the same way? Like what kind of things are they going to be able to do and what, you know, still needs to be done to make them feel more Mac-ish and less like phone apps running on a computer?
Is this kind of like Android on Chrome OS? Is that the idea, just to expand the universe?
I think it is. You know, that's the most apt comparison, I think, because Microsoft has made a couple different efforts to make this happen. But with Chrome OS, I think Google's intent is to expand the number of apps that are available without affecting the core functionality of Chrome OS for anybody who's already using it and happy with it. So it should be mostly additive. We'll see, you know, what kind of changes they make. They made a lot of changes in the beta, even to how these apps look and work, and even how things like scrolling and font rendering and that kind of stuff work. So it's still pretty early. It's still really early to say, you know, what kind of new apps we'll see and what kind of capabilities they'll have. But I'm tentatively optimistic, I think.
It seems to me, and I wasn't using the public beta, but it seems to me all the Macs I've installed it on, effortless install, effortless upgrade. I didn't have to do a clean install. I was able to upgrade in place. Even on one machine on my iMac Pro, which I had problems with the public beta, it went flawlessly. And I haven't heard a lot of cries of pain from users. Has this been a pretty rock-solid update for people?
As far as I've heard for other people, yes. For myself, definitely. Like there were in High Sierra, there were some rendering problems and some kernel panics and things that people were seeing all the way into the release build. Where I don't think that's the case with Mojave. Like it's the safest day one upgrade that yeah. they've done, I think, in a couple of years, which is nice.
And you compare this to the issues Microsoft's having with some of its big updates on Windows 10, the fall update and the spring yeah. update. This is impressive. This is really impressive. I think they've done a very nice job. There's a lot to like in this. Is there anybody who shouldn't upgrade to Mojave if they have a recent Mac that's capable?
I don't think so. I mean, you can make a case, I think, for waiting until, you know, one or two little point release updates have come out to squash any bugs or security problems that might have come up. Next year, the story will be different because, you know, the 32-bit app stuff is going away. OpenGL, OpenCL may or may not be there. There are a few other things that are going to get cut out just because Apple's, you know, kind of cleaning house and modernizing things like it always is. Back to My Mac is not available in Mojave anymore. So if
right.
you use that, maybe that's a reason not to upgrade.
But there are other remote access solutions. It's not like you have to have Back to My Mac. You can do
Yeah, yeah. I don't use that feature a lot, honestly.
I used to use it all the time. Yeah. I used to, but I haven't used it in a while.
I toyed with our version for a while, and no, I stopped.
Yeah.
Interesting idea, just bad execution.
Yeah. so, yeah, that's one thing people were upset about. That's gone. But, honestly, there are other choices out there, so it's not like remote access is dead.
Right. Yeah, they push iCloud as a partial solution, and that might work for some people as far as the file access thing
right.
goes. Like these days, I don't find that I need to remote into my desktop at home and use every single app on it, from a cafe or something. It's just not something that comes up a lot. So
that's one thing we have to remember. Yeah. Companies like Microsoft and Apple have lots of telemetry on what programs people use. And mm-hmm. while we may say, well, how could they take that out? It may be that a dozen people
exactly.
used it.
You're one
right.
of 10
right.
that really wanted that program.
Right.
Sorry.
Hey, Andrew, as always, bang up job. 17,000 well-written words everybody should read. ArsTechnica.com. It's not on the front page anymore, but a Google search will give it to you real quick. You've done a fantastic job, and I thank you on behalf of the entire Mac user community. Andrew writes.
Happy to do it.
On
yeah.
Twitter. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, everyone.
I hope you get some time to brush your hair in the future. I'm just teasing.
What?
Joking.
It's called
That's a
style, Leo.
It's a style.
It's
I understand.
A style.
It's a choice.
So I'm going to go.
Hey, thank you, Andrew. Have a good one.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
I have an old man haircut. I'm the last guy to ask. Kevin Rose used to do that all
right.
the time.
Right, you told me that makeup used to come and would do their hair, and then as soon as they left, he would go through his hair
stick
with his
it
hands.
Up. He'd want it to stick up. Yeah, the kids today.
It's a thing. It's a thing.
Coming up, I'm going to give you a review of this. This is another new
I've
Apple.
I've been waiting for that. Yeah,
yeah. The Apple Watch Series 4. But first, let's send Jason with VR goggles.
Let's drop him out of a plane
into a giant fan and see what happens.
Hey, what's up? We are in Pleasanton, and I'm wearing something pretty fancy. I think you would agree. You're probably wondering why I'm wearing this kind of a suit. And actually, it's because we're at a place called iFly, which means that I get to live a lifelong dream of actually seeing what it's like to skydive. But this is TWiT, right? So there has to be a technology angle. Skydiving is great. Well, they do skydiving in combination with virtual reality to simulate the entire experience. I am so pumped and slightly terrified, but we're going to literally jump into it right now.
The skydiving takes place inside a vertical wind tunnel that is blanketed with fans that push the air up. Wind is pushed through that tunnel at speeds that I saw starting around 120 miles per hour. My instructor showcased his own capabilities at speeds upwards of 180 miles per hour, which is pretty crazy. But none of this happened before I was given a solid education on what to expect.
What in the...
Hi, I'm Chris. I'll be your guide today.
This included learning a few hand signals that would help to guide me, the flyer, and keep my body in the air safely while wearing earplugs that are actually blocking the ear-piercing noise of the fans inside the tunnel. From there, I had to make sure that my suit fit me properly. Mental note, I'm insanely tall, so usually the answer is not really. And I had to get fitted with helmets and eye gear to protect me in flight. This was perhaps a bit more disconcerting when throwing the VR helmet on my head. I will admit, when I put the VR helmet on, I felt a moment of panic. The thought of being propelled into the air while wearing a Gear VR helmet was kind of getting to me a little bit. But then I realized it was because the helmet was a bit too small for my head. So, you know, it just didn't fit.
Oh, that's what I missed. I just had to go like this.
Once I replaced it with a larger VR helmet, I knew I'd be okay, and it was time to soldier on. From there, I headed into the wind tunnel waiting area. This is where you sit or pace nervously as you await your turn inside the wind tunnel. And after a quick recap of the hand signals and a once-over on my gear, I was ready to fall into the wind tunnel. Prepare for the VR flight, I had to first fly a few times with all senses in check to make sure I had the basics down before being blinded to the world with a VR goggle on my face. I'd literally fall into the door, arms above my head, with my instructor guiding my body into the air. It was a total leap of faith. But suddenly, I found myself midair, wind whisking every fold in my jumpsuit, my arms held out in front of me and in place firmly by the strong wind. The challenge was really all about being loose, but not too loose. If I tensed up, my body might not hover symmetrically, and the same could be said for when I let my limbs fall loose. The trick was finding that perfect balance, and obviously the hand signals really helped in finding that balance. My second flight was perhaps my best flight. I felt like I was totally on. This was where I felt truly in control of my body position in midair, and where I noticed my instructor has to do the least to keep me centered inside the wind tunnel. I did begin to tense up toward the end of that second flight and almost immediately noticed a shifting of my stability, which I quickly corrected. Holy cow! So then, after all of this, I was ready to throw on the modified helmet with a Samsung Gear VR embedded into it. Now, thankfully, with the helmet on, I was shown the pass-through camera while standing in the waiting area, so I wasn't completely shut off from the world. My instructor let me know that the experience was about to begin, and I was led over to the entrance of the tube. That's when the 360-degree immersive video began playback, and suddenly, there I was in the belly of a plane, surrounded by fellow divers getting ready to jump out. And on the count of three, I would lean forward through the door, hands in the air, and just trust that I'd make it into the air alive. Now, sure enough, the staff are absolute pros, and I suddenly found myself flying out of a plane, plummeting toward Dubai, United Arab Emirates. As I looked around me, I saw other skydivers making the trip with me and thought it was interesting at first. I quickly realized why the effect wasn't absolutely convincing, though. Sure, my brain felt being in midair and my eyes saw me above a city, but I wasn't convinced in the way I expected to be. In VR, it's very hard to really lock onto the spatial cues that clue you into this kind of travel. The ground is so far away that very quickly it really just seems like you're looking at a picture of a city from above versus actually plunging rapidly toward it. Not only that, the resolution that was achieved with the Gear VR and the resolution of the video that was being played were low enough that it really just kind of felt like, well, I'm wearing VR while skydiving more than anything else. Jumping out of the plane was perhaps the most exhilarating part because of the interactive element of pushing oneself into the unknown, timed with the visuals in VR. Hovering over the cityscape was maybe a mere taste of what it could become in due time, either with improved resolution, a more dimensional experience, or some other enhancement that we just haven't quite figured out yet.
All right, I had an amazing time. It's an exhilarating experience, including with VR. There's some potential there to kind of improve that experience and make it just a little bit more convincing. But I really liked what I saw, and I'm actually thinking I might bring my kids out and show them what it's all about. I think they'd be pretty excited to do it. I'm Jason Howell. I'll see you next time.
Jason gets to do all the fun stuff. Would you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I did something like this.
Yeah.
But then I touched the ceiling, and Willy Wonka told me I wouldn't win his factory anymore. And,
you got to stop eating those gobstoppers, man. They just turn you into blue goo.
I have gone skydiving. I did a tandem jump once.
Yeah.
And I'd love to go solo, but I Unfortunately, I am over the weight limit for the iFly.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
There are cruise ships. The Anthem of the Seas, RCIs, right, has an iFly on
it. You were on one of those, right?
Yeah. In fact, I have 360 video. No.
Oh, come on.
But Lisa's done it with Michael, our son. She's done it, and she loves it. She thinks it's a lot of fun. She's also jumped out of the plane.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, she's a thrill seeker. I'm just looking for a comfy hammock and a good book of poetry.
If you're already doing that, I feel like it would be exhilarating enough without...
I think the VR is interesting, though. If they could make it,
but
you know how it is sometimes with VR, that you know you're completely safe. You're in a room, but you put the glasses on and then you look down and you're on a 50-story building and your body somehow says, whoa!
Right?
It can convince your body. So I think that would be an interesting way to, in a safe way, skydive and get the experience.
See, I would put the headset on and then have like a room fan just blowing at me. I think I'm like 90% of the experience.
So I got, as you know, it's my job. Don't judge me. I got my fifth Apple Watch in practically as many years. One good thing Apple's done, this is the new Apple Watch Series 4.
It's a little bigger. It's a little beefier.
One good thing they've done is they've eliminated the high-priced edition. Right? Originally, remember, they had like a $30,000 gold one. And then they've been doing ceramic ones. And I, as a sucker, kept buying the ceramic ones, not realizing really that it's going to be obsolete in a year.
Right.
So this time, aluminum, baby, black aluminum. They still make stainless steel.
It looks nice.
This is fine. I mean, this is the less expensive one. It came with a fluoroelastomer plastic band, which I immediately replaced.
That's just fancy.
But the nice thing is the bands are compatible.
That band is a aftermarket.
No, this is Apple's Milanese loop. But that's the point, is that even though this new watch face is a little bit bigger, this is the 44 millimeter. The old bands will still work. You don't have to give it up. They say a 30% larger screen. I don't know how you can tell. One way you can, I guess, see the larger screen is this new infograph watch face that they offer only on the Series 4. This has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 complications. There's a new style of complication. That's those little widgets. There's the music complication. I can launch my chill mix. 12 gigabytes of storage now. And that's nice because, look, I can play it to my AirPods or my speaker. What's really nice, though, about having so much storage is not only can I put music in there, quite a bit of music, I can put my audiobooks. Audible now. It doesn't have a complication for it yet, but it does now support having audiobooks on it.
It really does add to that standalone functionality.
Absolutely. I don't have to bring my phone. Mm-hmm. This comes in LTE and non-LTE versions. Of course, I got the LTE version, and you can see the LTE signal there. This is on T-Mobile. Most of the carriers will offer some way of doing it for around $10 a month.
Right.
That means that you can still get notifications, messages, if your phone's not there, and you can even use the new feature, walkie-talkie.
Okay. See, I've heard a lot about this. Can you actually show it to me?
I can't because nobody I talk to is available right now. I made Lisa actually take my old Apple Watch so that we could walkie-talkie. We have done it. It's really cool. You get a big button on there. Now, the first time you connect with somebody, it'll do this, connecting to, and it's somehow establishing a connection. But once it's established that conversation, it's almost instantaneous. I press the button, you hold the talk, say something. It plays it on her watch. Within a second, she talks back to me. So you can have this back and forth, real-time conversation.
It reminds me of those, remember those Nextel phones? There's a generation that doesn't understand this.
They even make a Nextel yellow. Yeah. I mean, they know that. She said it reminded her of Stranger Things, like we were under the table talking on our walkie-talkies.
The old FRS radios.
Unfortunately, I've been seeing this a lot lately. It's not responding. Megan won't talk to me either. Maybe they just don't want to walkie-talkie with me. I don't know.
Well, you know what this means. You need another one so you can walkie-talkie yourself.
Hello, Leo.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, I'm great. How are you? The other
best conversation ever.
Ever. The other thing that this has is a new dual-core 64-gig chip. They call it the S4. Noticeably faster. Apps run faster. Everything launches faster. And it has helped the watch do better in a number of areas. For instance, my old Series 3 watch, when I'm working vigorously, will sometimes lose my heart rate. This one has yet to lose my heart rate, which is fantastic. It's very accurate, very reliable.
Just a better sensor, or is it making better contact?
Well, I wonder. Maybe it's a better sensor. It looks the same. Maybe it's making better contact. Maybe it's a faster chip. All in all, it's improved. The speaker's louder by 50%. They have the new fall detection in here, which I, at first, I decided not to turn on because I didn't want it to go off. It says when you first turn it on. Now, if you're very vigorous, it may detect falls when you're just really, you know, doing push-ups.
Right. Or slam dancing.
Or slam dancing. But then I realized, I'm not that vigorous. So I turned it on. This actually is great for older people or people who, you know, maybe you live alone. If you have a fall, it will detect it, and it will call 911 and your designated
respondent. But it gives you a moment to cancel.
Absolutely.
Right?
It plays a loud noise. There's a, you know, you can say, no, that wasn't a fall. That was breakdancing. I've yet to trigger it by accident, even in vigorous workouts. So,
well, Renee Ritchie tried to trigger it, right?
Watch this. This is Renee's, he's from iMore, our host on MacBreak Weekly. His review of the Apple Watch 4, he simulated falls.
Did it actually trigger?
I don't know.
Well, they were saying in the chat room that it's only on by default if you're over 65. Otherwise, you have to turn it on. For you, it was disabled by default,
I had to
right?
turn it on. Okay. That's right, but I did turn it on. It does also have the, you know, as previous Apple Watches have had, the high heart rate.
Right.
The default is 120. So if your heart rate gets above 120 without you actually moving around
doing
a lot,
anything,
it'll notify you. And people report that, you know, they're watching a football game and they'll say, your heart rate's very high. What's going on? They also now have low heart rate detection. So if my heart rate goes below a certain point and you can set that point, it will also say, hey, are you okay?
So your heart hasn't beat for 3 minutes. You should probably call the doctor.
Either this man is dead or my Apple Watch has stopped. I don't know how useful those are, but they're nice.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, there's been a lot of hype about what it can and cannot do.
Right.
I love the fact that they are including that, because then you can actually develop for it.
Right.
You know, one of the dreams of the wearable technology has been to give your doctor more than just a snapshot. Because right now you get, what, maybe the blood tests, maybe a scan, and then the 20 minutes your doctor sees you, and he has to be able to diagnose what's been happening to you for the last 6 months and what might happen for the next six. Imagine being able to show him or give him in advance a detailed layout of what your health looked like through every
exactly.
day of the last six
yeah.
months. That could really actually improve the quality of our healthcare. So I don't care if it lives up to the hype right now, as long as it's possible to use it for an application like
that. I think that's absolutely right. Down the road, this is going to be of real value. There's some controversy as well about the electrocardiogram.
Yeah.
It's a two-sensor ECG. Not available yet, by the way. Sometime later this fall. But one sensor, of course, is already on your wrist. You put your finger on the stem, the winding stem, and then it will, between the two sensors, measure your heart pattern, can send it to a doctor. This is much like the Alive Cardia. Both
right,
have been approved by
right.
the FDA, but many doctors have said, well, it's nothing compared to the traditional 12-sensor ECG. But after all, that's probably what would happen. You'd say, well, I don't know. The doctor would say, well, do you feel all right? I don't feel all right. Send me the result from your watch, which mm-hmm. you could do. Come in, because we need to do a full EKG on you right now. That's the kind of thing. It's kind of a warning system, not so much a diagnostic system.
Now, Leo, I know that they actually decreased the size of the battery because they've made some of the other components
more
efficient.
That's a little weird.
Have you noticed a hit to battery life?
So they claim that the battery life is actually improved. They use that phrase, all-day battery life, mm-hmm. which for them is 18 hours. But then iFixit took it apart and said, whoa, wait a minute. This is actually a smaller battery, mm-hmm. even though it's a bigger case. This is a 44 millimeter. I never had problems with battery life on my old Apple Watch. You'll use more battery when you use it for workouts, which
right.
I do almost every day. But it still gets me through most of the day. It's rare that I'll get back with this new Apple Watch. And you know, I've been wearing it for about a week now, so I don't have a huge amount of experience. But it's rare. It's never been that I'd get back and, oh, my gosh, the battery's dead. Usually it's got a quarter or more left, 25% or more left. So, you know, is there less battery life than before? I don't know. I never had a problem before. I still don't have a problem today.
You know, the number one usage of power on a phone is the screen. The number one usage of power on a watch is going to be the radios.
Yeah.
The radio, so
this has a lot of radios, by the way.
Right. But my guess is they've just gone in and they've tweaked when the radios are on, when they're off, and when they're at partial power.
They have a lot of control of this.
They have
an LTE radio, a Bluetooth radio, mm-hmm. and a Wi-Fi radio. I mean, there's a lot of transmitting and receiving going on in here, but you're exactly right.
Yeah.
I bet you it's not all the time. The fact that when I do that walkie-talkie, it takes about 30 seconds to say the connection, that means those radios are off, it's turning them on,
precisely.
It's doing some searching. So I think all of that makes sense. On the other hand, this to me is the way, and I said this on Series 3 last time, I say it, it's even more true today. This is the Apple Watch that Apple kind of hinted at when it first came out with the Apple Watch. This is the Apple Watch that Apple wanted, was aiming at, and I love it. I have to say it's become a day, and I was very skeptical for the first three generations. This has become a daily wear item. It actually started with the Series 3. I wear this every day now. I use it when I exercise. I use it for maps. When we were traveling on the cruise, I had my old Series 3. I used it to, you know, drop a pin when we get off the boat. How do I get back to the boat? Drop a pin. The watch will navigate me back. There's a lot of great uses for this. I'm rarely without my phone, and I do have the XS Max or the XS Max, and we'll talk about that at another time. Really like that as well. But this, without even without the phone, is great. Lisa's now, you know, wearing hers to go work out because she can listen to the music. She can listen to an audiobook. WatchOS 5, if you've got an older watch, is definitely an upgrade to get. And if you don't yet have an Apple Watch or it's time to upgrade, I would absolutely recommend the Series 4 Apple Watch. They start at $400. You're probably going to spend a little bit more than that, especially if you want LTE.
If you're looking for a watch, this would be a good one to start with. But then my question to you would be, if you have a Series 3, is this worth the upgrade?
Oh, probably not, although I like this infographic face because I look at all this stuff. I have the calendar. I have Lisa's picture. I can, you know, show her phone number, email, text message her. I mean, I have to say, this there's a lot of functionality. I use drafts all the time. That's built in. And we're seeing, by the way, companies starting to add the capabilities for these super complications that are exclusive to the infographic. Yeah, I think it's great. I look how fast these apps are launching.
It does seem speedy.
Noticeably speedier than the old Apple Watch. You know, I really think this is great. And by the way, if there's one killer feature of the new Apple Watch, it's the ability to play Pokemon Go on the watch while you're walking around, even if your phone isn't around.
It's funny that you say that because I've been walking about 5 miles a day in Rome, and I just realized I haven't turned on Pokemon Go. I should have had it on so I could have some
eggs.
You're
missing the boat. There's probably some great stuff in Vatican City. You could get a great Pokemon there.
We have the Popemon.
It's the Popemon.
Special edition.
You said it, not me. You want to excommunicate anybody? He said it, not me. Anyway, I'm a big fan. I've completely come around on the Apple Watch. My first reaction is, this is dopey. Nobody wants this. My second reaction, well, it's kind of like a sidecar on a motorcycle. If you've got the motorcycle and you want it to do other things, that's handy, I guess. Now, as a standalone device, as a watch, as a utility, this is fantastic. The walkie-talkie alone makes it.
So it finally has
a Pokemon
a real
is nearby,
use case.
A wild Nidoran. Should we try to capture it?
No. A Nidoran? You don't need a Nidoran.
I don't need, they're like rabbits.
That's a garbage Pokemon.
They're everywhere. Pokemon. Garbage Pokemon.
Tell me when you get a Lampras. I need another one.
Oh,
of those.
I need a Lampras. I just got a Gyarados. You know, that's an evolved Magikarp.
Well, you need 400 of those.
You do. You need a lot of candy.
Magikarp candy.
I worked hard to get my Magikarp candy. You're still playing, I think.
I've turned it on.
I'll have to show you the new app called Pokemon.
There are so many Pokestops in the Vatican. It's ridiculous.
Who the hell is playing Pokemon
They're
Go in the
over
Vatican?
The place.
All right.
There's even one right over the Pope's residence. I'll leave it up to you to figure out which one that is. I did not put it there.
It doesn't say the Pope's residence.
No.
It's just somewhere.
It's in Italian, so.
The Pope is a residence. All right. Anyway, I'm very happy with the Apple Watch. I think they've really knocked it out of the park. It's getting better all the time. These new health features, while right now they're mostly a marketing gimmick, I think you're right.
I think
ultimately, that's going to be a
future functionality.
A very important thing. Aluminum, there's three versions, cellular only, three stainless steel options. You know, I saved the money and I got the aluminum because you know what? There's going to be one next year and I'm going to have to buy it.
Mine's carbon fiber.
That is not an Apple Watch.
It's not an Apple Watch.
What is that?
It's not even an Android watch. It's a smart-ish watch.
Is that ish.com?
No, this is...
Oh, okay. We're going to wrap things up with a mailbag. I'll find out in the mailbag. But first, after spending months, and I'm not kidding, months, testing DIY smart security systems, Florence Ion of All About Android gave us her favorite picks. This was on Know How with Megan Maroney. Watch.
We're going to start with the Simply Safe. This is actually my favorite. It is not the most versatile of the security systems in the sense that it doesn't have all the smart home smarts of, say, like Abode, which we'll talk about in a bit. But it is great because it is really stylish, first of all. I really just like this cylindrical, you know, look and feel. This is actually the siren. This siren is pretty darn loud. I believe this is in the 100 range decibels. So it has built-in cellular backup. It comes with four different sensors. So you get three entry sensors and one motion sensor that comes with it. The starting price for this is around $260. It also has battery backup and it has Alexa Nest and IFTTT integration. We've got a couple other ones here. This is the Abode. It comes with the, so what you see here is just like this box. It just kind of looks like a box. But then it has Ethernet on the back here, so you can plug it in, which I absolutely love when a security system comes with Ethernet because Wi-Fi sometimes is just too much to deal with. It's also got cellular backup, so you'll see there's a little SIM card slot here.
We need to mention that SimpliSafe is a Twit sponsor. Not a sponsor of this show, but a Twit sponsor.
Yes, thank you very much, actually. So, fun fact about these guys is they're actually an offshoot, I want to say, of another big security company. I can't remember who exactly. So it's a really nice, dependable security system. It's really simple. This took me less than 5 minutes to set up. The really essentials kit is $280, and it comes with fewer sensors than the SimpliSafe, which was another reason I liked the SimpliSafe more. This only has one entry sensor and one motion sensor, which makes it really good if you have an apartment. However, the other nice thing about this is that it has Zigbee and Z-Wave integration. So it actually works as a smart home hub. So you can hook up third-party motion sensors, security systems, Philips Hue light bulbs can be controlled through this, and it is just nice and versatile in that way. The only bummer is that you have to do it all through an online portal. I want to show something that's a little out of the norm.
Okay.
If we can. So this is a security system that's really good if you've got like an elderly parent, somebody you kind of want to watch on, but you don't want to install a professional monitoring system because you don't want to deal maybe with false alarms, which we'll talk why that's annoying later. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you want to be able to just keep track of what's going on. So this is actually a VoIP service from Ooma. So this is an answering machine. Remember what those look like? See, you got play and pause buttons here. These are all, you know, all antiquated things, but I have to say VoIP service is really nice, crystal clear calling. So if you're looking for at-home landline, this is great because it also works through an app, so you get access to the phone number through the app. Now, you have to sign up for the VoIP service to get the security with this, but the nice thing about it is that this is super affordable. It's $180 for the kit. It comes with two sensors, so a motion sensor and an entry sensor. You can also buy like water leak sensor and like a garage door sensor. And then what's nice about it is it doesn't have professional monitoring, but you can add parties to the account so that if something goes on, like a door is open, five people can be contacted at the same time. But it doesn't have professional monitoring, so the police won't come. It does have emergency services, though. So the number is connected to the house that it's in, so emergency services will know your location the minute you call from that number. And it also has a tiny, tiny bit of Alexa Nest and IFTTT integration, but that's with the VoIP service, not so much with the smart home stuff.
Okay.
So the fun thing about DIY security is that you think you're going to save a bunch of money from the professional installation people. And that's partly true. You will save some money. I mean, this is definitely a fraction of the cost of how much it costs to have them come out and do all this. But that also depends on the size of your house. If your house is really big, you're going to need a lot more sensors and a lot more sensors of all sorts and maybe more sirens and things. So that will add to costs, not to mention the subscription prices. So the Abode has a free tier, but it doesn't include professional monitoring. But it's nice because it has like 3 days of timeline storage. So you can find out what events have been going on. SimpliSafe does not have a free tier, but it starts at $14.99 with $24.99 being the professional monitoring costs. But again, that includes cellular backup, you know, environmental monitoring, secret alerts, 30-day storage, these sorts of things. SimpliSafe also has pay as you want. I believe Abode does as well, so you don't have to pay. You only pay when you're on vacation. So you only pay when you actually need it. You know, I work from home. I don't really need professional. I'm always there. If you want the full breakdown, just go to my Tom's Guide article and you could see there's a whole hub of the best DIY security systems.
That is a lot.
That's
of DIY
lot
security.
IoT, my goodness.
Yes.
Oof. Although I don't necessarily equate IoT with secure.
Yeah, that seems like a contradiction in terms.
Yeah. Actually, right now, the only devices I trust are the devices that will automatically update.
Do you, let me just ask you. Yeah, that's a, in fact, yeah. That's our bottom line is don't buy an IoT. Yeah. Stacey Higginbotham says that. Don't buy an IoT device unless it's got automatic regular updates because there's going to be a flaw. Do you have IoT stuff? Are you in, like, you're there, you're living in Vatican City. You're living steps away from the St. Peter's Basilica, from the Holy See. Do you have stuff in there? Like, do you have you set up an IoT?
The equipment that I brought, from the networking equipment to the 3D printers to the production equipment, it is by far the most advanced equipment in the Vatican.
That is awesome.
It's.
Did you send a container out? What did you do?
No, I've flown back and forth a lot. Oh, so you and I get a package a lot. I just slept. Nice.
You should get a box. You make a box like this. You press the button and it comes out. Hand comes out and turns it off. And then you should just show that to the Pope.
I could do that.
I'm just curious what he would do. Just thinking, you know. That's a cool.
He'll be over next week.
To your house?
Yeah.
He's coming over?
Seriously, it's just a couple of steps.
For a barbecue?
No, we do barbecues up on the roof, but it's getting to be winter and it rains a lot.
So. Okay, just a tip: if you're going to do a barbecue, make sure you don't send the white smoke. I'm just saying. Okay.
Now, when that happens again, I have a camera that is focused on that chimney. So,
by the way, if that happens again, and I guess it will,
at some point these things
happen, and you happen to be there, pack your bags because it won't be a Jesuit.
It will not be.
And you know what happens. I will be coming home. You'll be coming home, which is good. That's what we're hoping for. We're looking for that white smoke. It is mailbag time. I am not sacrilegious. I don't want to.
No, I don't.
Tell me if I'm saying something bad.
Oh, no. Actually, that's a conversation I've had, so.
Okay. You know, when we were in Malta, which, by the way, is like 80%, 90% Catholic. It's very devout because that's, of course, who could forget where St. Paul was shipwrecked there?
That's where
he
washed up.
Right, he washed up.
So you went down to his prison, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of cool. And we're there, and we're standing outside of St. John's Co-Cathedral, which is a beautiful, you've done masses in there. It's a beautiful Baroque cathedral. And well, I confess, Lisa and I, we're standing there. You tell us what we were doing.
You were...
We were playing Pokemon Go.
Did you get any special Caravaggio Pokemon?
No, I wish we had. Two Maltese teenagers come up. They don't speak English very well, and they go, Zapdos, Zapdos. And we follow them like three blocks to a raid, and then another guy joins us, and we're all going like this. I wish I had pictures.
I see it in Rome because I do have to walk every day, and I see, you know, there's no everyone's using their phone, but every once
you
in a while
tell.
You'll get that.
Because it's like, this movement that's you're Pokemon. Firing a Pokeball. Mm-hmm. We're playing Pokemon Go. We did not get the Zapdos. I'm sad to say. We tried twice.
By the way, Malta, a lot of people don't know this. It was the most bombed city in World War II.
It's an amazing story. Malta, I had never been there. We spent 2 days there, and I could spend 2 years there. There is so much history. It's been occupied since 3,500, 4,000 BC. Yeah. It's an amazing thing. There was an entire culture there, a Neolithic culture. They didn't have metals. They didn't have iron. But they built amazing stuff, and then they disappeared. And no one knows where they went.
And we had a tour guide who, she had this wonderful line, because there's that wall around the seaport.
Yeah.
Right? And she said, the Maltese built this because they kept getting invaded.
Right.
It has only been used once in wartime, and that was by the French against the Maltese, because the French took it, and then the Maltese couldn't
it's
get
Napoleon,
past the wall they
man.
Built.
They did not like Napoleon. He was no fan... He had no fans in Malta. Pick a email there. Any one of those. Right. Let's see who has email number
Who's
one.
Who's got what?
You know what? I almost always get email one. You got email one.
There we go. Mm-hmm. This comes from Greg, and he says, hello. How can I limit my data from getting into the hands of my evil, evil ISP? He didn't add that part. Google, etc. You get the picture. Thank you. Okay, yeah, actually, this is a question that I'm sure you get all the time. Yeah. People are, and this is good because people are starting to wise up to the fact that a lot of information can be gathered about where they visit, what they do, how long they spend online. And so what he's looking for is a way to sort of obfuscate that. Now, let me start by saying there is absolutely 100 positively no way to completely disappear from your ISP because you're connected. So they will, at the very least, they will know.
They'll know you're there.
You're there, and they'll know how much data you're sending.
Right.
Okay. But what you can do is you can make it very difficult for them to track what you're actually doing with that data transfer.
I'm so glad this guy asked this question, because people always complain about Google and Facebook. But you know who knows more about you than Google and Facebook? It's your internet service provider. Yep. They know everything.
Absolutely everything. Absolutely
so, everything. So what do you do?
Okay, so there's a couple things. First, all you have to do is turn on incognito browsing, and that solves everything.
No.
No, what? Absolutely not. People still believe
nothing.
That. People still believe
nothing.
That. I know. It's nothing. All that does is it stops the cookies in your browser.
The browser
from working.
Doesn't save your history. That's
right.
It.
But what you actually need is something that will encrypt / obfuscate right. where your traffic is going.
Now, the easiest thing to do, and you tell me, would be to not use the ISP's domain name system, their
correct.
DNS server. And there's 1.1.1.1 from Cloudflare. There's Quad9.
8.8.8.8 from Google, although he says no Google.
Yeah.
OpenDNS.
There's OpenDNS. We like them.
208.672.222.222 right. or 220.220.
Cool. Cloudflare created Quad1 specifically. Mm-hmm. So that you could use it instead of your internet service provider's domain name system. That way, at least, they could still see the traffic. They probably still can know where you're going.
Right.
But they at least aren't doing the domain resolution.
Precisely.
For you.
Now, you could use a VPN service. But
that would block that, right?
That blocks that. So it makes a tunnel.
Right.
So your
all
ISP,
they know is you're going to this one spot.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But then you have to trust the VPN provider.
They know everything.
They have
your ISP. You're just kicking the can down the road.
Precisely. What I've actually liked is I've liked Tor. Now, Tor has a host of problems all on its own, but it's incredibly easy to set up.
It anonymizes you.
And anonymizes
doesn't
you.
Doesn't it slow you down?
All of these solutions are going to slow you down. Because if you can imagine, if you go from a semi-straight line or a couple of hops to where you're going to something that is by design circuitous.
Sending you all over the world.
Sending you all around the world to your place.
That's how it anonymizes you.
Correctly. Now, this is something that we created on a late episode of Know How. It's called the LiPi. It's basically a battery-powered Raspberry Pi. Now, the reason why I have this one is I've actually turned this into a Tor server. So if I plug in an Ethernet cable here and turn it on, and this will operate for like 8 hours before I have to plug it in. It means any traffic I pass through here via its Wi-Fi connection is going to go through the Tor system. I don't have to run a Tor browser extension.
It does it automatically.
It does it automatically. Now, this is I consider this the easiest way to do it because I have this configured that if the Tor breaks, so if it stops anonymizing, your traffic stops.
Oh, that's good.
Which, unfortunately, even some commercial VPNs don't do that. They might pop up a notice saying the VPN's not working.
You're no longer secure.
It will continue to pass the traffic.
Yeah.
Now, I would say this is probably the solution I would use, just because it's something you own, it's something you can control, and you don't really have to trust anybody. Because
it's not a Tor endpoint itself.
It's not, no.
It sends you out to a Tor endpoint.
Correct. Sends you
now,
into the network.
I have something similar to this if you don't want to build your own from a Raspberry Pi. And I've mentioned this before, that the folks at Tiny Hardware Firewall
right.
make something that's essentially the same thing. It's based probably on a Marvell processor, but it has built-in VPN and Tor, which you can turn on just by a click. It does the same idea. So it's going to be in between you and the outside world. So build one, which would be the cheapest thing to do. And Tor is free.
You can also get extensions for your browsers.
And they even make a Tor browser.
Correct. Onion browser. You can get plugins for Firefox. I'm not big on those. I would use those in a pinch. But again, I don't like the fact that a lot of times the routing will fail.
And you won't know.
That's unacceptable.
My biggest problem with Tor is just the speed hit.
Oh, yeah. The speed hit is ridiculous.
So I really would only use Tor when you absolutely positively have to be anonymous. It's not a full-time solution to ISP snooping, in my opinion, right?
Yeah. And the other thing you may want to consider is there is some traffic that I need to protect. Anytime I'm going to my email servers, anytime I'm going to any data-containing servers, I will take the speed hit to make sure that it's secure.
Got it.
If I'm going to Amazon or Netflix, I don't care if you're tracking me because, of course, I'm going there.
Everybody goes
so
there.
So you can set up split tunnels. You say, okay, if it's this traffic going to these ports, to these services, encrypt.
Is that you can do that on this?
You can do that on this.
And what is the software you're running on?
So this is just the Tor software that you get from Git.
Oh.
So it's entirely open source. That's why you can customize it any way you
want.
That's
interesting.
And so what I tell it is, if I'm going here, run it through the Tor. If I'm not, just send it straight out. Let the ISP see where I'm going.
How hard is that to set up? Is it like kind of like IP tables? Or?
It's IP tables.
Just a rule table.
Completely simple. It's really simple. I mean, there might be a tutorial that you'll have to read.
Right.
But after you do it two or three times, you'll start going, that's where I put it in.
Nice. Which know-how is this so we can watch the show?
I will find it.
Just search for LiPi.
LiPi.
L-I-P-I.
Yeah.
Know-how space LiPi, and you'll go right to that episode.
There you go.
Nice. My question says, hello. Thank you very much. We help you enjoy. No, there's more. I'm selling my 1080 Ti that was last year the number one GPU. So old. We'd have a 2080 powered Monster Gaming Rig after realizing one day I'll never need all that power for the games I play. Isn't that sad? Aww, but it's true.
It is very true.
So I need help picking out a laptop that meets the following requirements. Can edit 4K video moderately well. As an SD card slot will last at least 3 years. I hope you guys can help me out. You guys are awesome. I really want to fly out someday to watch, says Sheil.
Aw.
Thank you, Sheil.
Now, good news. There's actually an abundance of options. All the major manufacturers, Dell, Acer.
I'm a Lenovo fan.
Lenovo.
You know. Yep.
Apple. They all make notebooks that will fit this bill.
But Apple will not fit the bill for one reason. SD cards.
That's the problem. That's
so
the problem.
Frustrating.
And actually, on a lot of those, except the Acer, they also don't include the SD card.
They're starting
slot.
To phase those they're out. Because
it's so easy to get a USB-C dongle, and they're inexpensive. So I honestly don't let that stop you from getting the best
one. What do you need to edit 4K video? What is the minimum CPU and GPU?
i7. And you're going to want something that...
Probably 8th generation would be nice.
8th generation would be nice. I wouldn't go with an i9, and let me explain that.
I love my i9.
I love the i9, but the problem with putting so much firepower in a laptop is the dissipation. You know this.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how fast the chip is. If it's not able to dissipate all the heat it's going to generate, it has to derate itself in order not to melt.
I have to say, Apple's i9, and there was a lot of, if you will, heat on the Apple... i9-based MacBook Pro, actually handles this quite well. And I've looked carefully at the throttling. I am able to get the speed I want. You're right. If you were doing something that required, like, for instance, if you're cross-compiling a video, moving it from one codec to another, that would be continually hitting the CPU. Yes, it probably would throttle it. You wouldn't get the full throughput. But for most of what you do, like editing 4K video, where they're are bursts, and then it's going to calm down a little bit. This is a good choice. But you're right, i9. If what you're saying is re-encoding, I want full speed re-encoding. That's not a good choice, probably.
And
even i7s will thermal out on this.
Oh, precisely. Yeah. And let's dig down even further. Because he does gaming and video editing, the part that will overheat is really the GPU, not necessarily the CPU.
Right.
So what I would suggest is. My favorite super high-end notebook right now is a Razer, the ones that they built for gaming.
We like that. We had one for review. I was very impressed. They make an i9 version of this, but maybe you should go with the i7.
Yeah, the i7. I would go with the i7, and I would go one step further. I would go with the Razer Blade Stealth. It starts at about $1,700. Decent specs, but the nice thing is it doesn't have that core box. So you put a full-size GPU into an external enclosure.
Yeah, we had the core box,
Yeah, that's... Honestly,
that's an external GPU solution.
That's the best way to go because that's got the best thermal dissipation you can possibly get.
That's
if you're looking for something that can do 4K video that's not going to throttle itself down halfway through the render, that's really the only other option because everything that tries to do it inside the case, 100%, I guarantee if you're doing 4K video for any project longer than 30 seconds, you're going to hit a point at which it has to throttle down.
It's rendering and transcoding that really will eat up that heat envelope. Cause problems.
See, that's the Razer Blade 15. They also have the Razer Blade Stealth, which is a 13.3-inch
screen.
That's
the one you like, the little
that's,
one.
I like that. Because I love the fact that I could take it, and it acts like an ultrabook.
Is that what you're using for editing?
I left it in Rome, though. I can take it with me when I'm traveling, and then when I come back, I plug it into that external GPU, and it's a monster.
That's a great solution, And it's actually very pretty.
It's a very
I second that motion. The Razer Stealth...
Yes.
Razer Blade Stealth.
There's the Pro, which is a 17-inch monitor, but then it's a desktop replacement.
No.
Oh, get the little one.
Portable, right?
Yeah.
And then when you get to your desktop, you plug it into a bigger screen and plug it into the GPU, and you've got all the power of
actually,
desktop.
You know what my screen is?
I don't even want to know. You left your 43-inch screen here.
I got, it's the same one.
You got another one?
So I feel right at home.
Who pays for this stuff? I know you don't. You have a vow of poverty. Doesn't a vow of poverty mean you're not allowed to have a 43-inch?
I may have gotten a couple of benefactors.
Oh, people like you. That's the thing.
I got a thing.
You're allowed. Yeah. That's allowed.
I didn't buy anything.
It's a donation.
Yeah. Just, you know, because they thought it was taking up space in their house.
It's worthwhile. You didn't take mine, did you?
No, yours is still... No one is using it. No one's using it.
It's too big.
What's going on?
It's this big.
It's the best monitor in the studio.
You actually bought another or got donated another one?
Yeah.
I should have just given this to you to take with you.
How would I take it with
me? How do you
get
it on the plane? Under your arm?
Yeah, actually, that would be the coolest. No, it's carry-on.
Strap it to your back like a turtle. Robert, it's great to see you. Here's some good news. You're coming back tomorrow for This Week in Tech.
Of course.
So he'll be on our round table. And then you sky back to Vatican City, but you'll be back in town for CES.
That's correct. So I'm coming back in January. I'll be in San Francisco for a while, then going over to Vegas, then probably coming back to San Francisco. So
I hope we get to see you.
Yeah, of course. Anytime I come back, you know I'm going to try to get to the studio.
Yeah, yeah. It's always great to see the Digital Jesuit at PadreSJ on Twitter, Father Robert Ballas there.
Not on Facebook, not on Instagram. You can
really? You're not doing Facebook?
No.
Not Instagram? Mm-hmm. But you're staying with Twitter.
I'm staying with Twitter for now.
You say good things. I enjoy your tweets.
Well, because I
used to anyway.
I'm going
to
end all my tweets from now on with funding secured. Bring it on, SEC.
That's actually a great idea.
Let's go.
We should all do that. I have a few things I want to mention, and it was written on here, so I'm going to get it back, because we do have a new podcast, a couple of new podcasts,
yes.
I think, that we want to tell everybody about. Valley of Genius. This is the one Adam Fisher and I do. Have you listened to it? So Adam Fisher came in to talk about his book, Valley of Genius, and he just offhandedly mentioned what this book is interviews with 200 of the most amazing people that built Silicon Valley, right? And he mentions, I got them all on tape. I said, what? And you made a book? That's a podcast, dude. So he's been bringing in Woz and Nolan Bushnell.
That's so awesome.
And all these great voices. People, he interviewed Woz at some chili joint in Silicon Valley. It's hysterical.
It was so Woz, too. It's incredible.
That's exactly
how you expect Woz to speak.
Twit.tv/VOG, and there's going to be a new one every week, and I don't see any end to this because he's got hundreds of hours of tape. So thank you, Adam Fisher. Make sure you subscribe, twit.tv/VOG, or just search for Valley of Genius. You can subscribe to this show, too, NSS, twit.tv/NSS. Again, while you're searching for VOG, search for NSS in your favorite podcast client. You can even say, hey, Echo, play the new screensavers on TuneIn, and it will play it for you. We have a flash briefing that we do. If you have an Echo, make sure you add us to your flash briefing. Bits of Twit all throughout your briefing. Subscribe to our newsletter, twit.tv/newsletter. And, of course, subscribe to the show. If you want to watch the show live, you can do that at twit.tv/live every Saturday, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. You can also listen live or download a copy. Let's see. Oh, and if you're going to be watching or listening live, you ought to be in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. Do you go in there once in a while?
Ever since I got to Rome, I'm in there under different names now.
Oh, really?
And always under something that changes my IP address. I lurk. Look, I lurked before I was a host on the Twit TV network.
Do you not want me to know what handles you're using, or do you?
No. It's fine. They will always be Jesuit saints. So if you know the Jesuit saints, you know which one's me.
I don't. Okay. But I am going to look for a Pokemon sometime around town. Thank you, Father Robert. Thank you all for watching, and we'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.